So my subject today is Paris in the era of Impressionism that will run from the Second Empire through the turn of the century, in effect, the Dreyfus Affair. Major transformations happened in the city of Paris, the city itself. And forgive me, this is a history lesson. Some of you will have learned it all long ago in school, but perhaps it will be a useful refresher for that reason. The city was redesigned, and it's not just the city itself that changed the look and design of the city, but also its politics, which were transformed in quite dramatic fashion. Mentioned the redesign of Paris in the middle of the 19th century, and the name of the Baron Georges Haussmann comes straight away to mind. He was prefect of the Seine in the 1850s and 1860s, senior administrator in the Paris region, and oversaw a vast program of public works. 85 miles of new street were constructed, paved, mostly gas lit. And not only that, a new grid plan was created. Technology always terrifies me. All right, it works. Here is the design. What Haussmann contributed to Paris in terms of street construction, and Parisians that many of you are, you know the general. There are two concentric circles, an inner set of boulevards, an outer set of boulevards, with spokes radiating from a central intersection, essentially the Place du Châtelet. Along the inner ring of boulevards were constructed, beginning in the 1830s with the Gare Saint-Lazare in 1837, a whole series of railroad stations. Having mentioned the Gare Saint-Lazare, I'll show you this painting by Claude Monet, which was done 40 years after the Gare Saint-Lazare was completed, which in a manner of speaking is while it was still relatively new. The Gare Saint-Lazare was the first, followed by the Gare du Nord in 1846, and then on down the line, Gare de l'Est, Gare de Lyon, Gare d'Austerlitz, Gare Montparnasse, and last of all, the Gare d'Orsay in 1900. The construction boom that Haussmann started and the railroad boom that accompanied it were boons to the city's economy. Paris knew decades of growth, almost uninterrupted, of a kind it would not experience again until les Trente Glorieuses of the 20th century. The transformations of Paris's city politics in the decades of mid-century were every bit as momentous. Haussmann, as you know, was not an elected official, nor did he serve an elected official. He served at the pleasure of his emperor, Louis Napoleon, or Napoleon III. Napoleon III's regime was of a very peculiar, interesting design. It was an authoritarian regime, but one of a very unusual nature. It was born of a coup d'etat, as you all know. Civil liberties were sharply curtailed. Freedom of the press, freedom of association was not legal to sing La Marseillaise, for example. But there was a parliament, and there were elections on the basis of universal manhood suffrage. The regime managed to win these elections consistently until the late 1860s, and there are a number of explanations for that. One, of course, it was a period of good times. One historian has spoken of these decades, the 50s, 60s, as l'apogée du monde rural, as a high point for peasant France. Not only that, Louis Napoleon's prefects used state funds and resources, don't know how to put it in a polite way, to manage the elections and to get the desired results. There were official candidates financed by the state. And last of all, the regime had recourse to a series of wars. victorious in the main until, of course, the final one, which I'll talk about in a minute. The war in Crimea in the early 1850s, the war alongside Italy against Austria at the end of the 50s, then, of course, the expedition to Mexico. And I show you here a painting by Edouard Manet, The Execution of the Emperor Maximilian. This was made fresh after the event happened. The French expedition, which was a debt-collecting expedition, was launched in 1862. The French took advantage of the circumstance to impose a friendly potentate, an emperor, there wasn't a throne of Mexico, it created the throne of Mexico, the Emperor Maximilian. And when French troops were withdrawn, there was an uprising against Maximilian, and he was executed. The painting is quite wonderful. You'll notice it's an echo of a Goya painting, and I would just ask you for the moment to pay attention to the design, the stance of the soldiers, because it's a scene Manet would use again, a formal scene that he would use once more. And then finally, there was the war against Prussia in 1870. And this war was a disaster. France's armies were defeated and the emperor himself taken prisoner. Back in Paris, news of the catastrophe sparked an insurrection, which in a period of months led to the creation of a revolutionary municipal government, the Paris Commune, or just simply the Commune, that as of March 1871. It won't last much longer than 2 months. It would be crushed in May 1871, but it was an unusual phenomenon. It was the first self-proclaimed revolutionary socialist government in world history. It didn't last long enough to leave much of a record, but it left behind a set of symbols, perhaps the best known, well, there are many good well-known ones, is the red flag. Which is still the flag, no longer of the Soviet Union, which doesn't exist, but still the flag of China, the color of its flag. And it, of course, bequeathed the song of World Revolution. The lyrics to the Internationale were written by an ex-communard, Eugène Potier. I will not sing the song for you. And of course, Karl Marx himself thought the event was worthy of his attention, and he devoted an entire pamphlet to the subject, Civil War in France, La Guerre Civile en France. And the Commune would also leave its traces on the face of Paris. The insurrection of March 1871 found some echo outside of the capital city, but not much. France's armies, though defeated in the Franco-Prussian War, regrouped and launched an assault on Paris, and the city's walls were breached in May of 1871, leading to street-to-street combat, finally winding up in Père Lachaise Cemetery, where the last communards made their stand, at what's now the Wall of the Federals, and something you can do to visit. Well, 100,000 people were killed, taken prisoner, or exiled. And this in a city that is under 2 million in population, it leaves a massive mark on the memory of the city and also physical scars as well. The Tuileries Palace is partially destroyed, and of course the Hotel de Ville is burned down in its entirety. And if I remember the metro station, they have an image of that scene of the Hotel de Ville aflame. So the Commune is defeated. The Second Empire is gone. And what kind of government will France have? Well, the electoral system is still in place. Universal manhood suffrage, dating back to 1848 revolution, preserved by the Second Empire. And now the French are going to get, I feel certain foolishness saying the French when you're right here in front of me, when you will have a chance to vote without the Second Empire's administrative apparatus helping you to decide. In the first years, after 1871, monarchists do well, but gradually Republicans begin to take their place. In greater and greater number. But before I turn to that, let me just show you this image from the fighting at the very end of the Paris Commune. Edouard Manet is said to have come to the city and to have witnessed the final battles. And this print is a representation of the barricade. It is Versailles soldiers executing communards. Now, once again, you will see the echo in this painting of the positioning of the soldiers in the execution of the Emperor Maximilian. So this wasn't sketched on the scene. It was borrowing former elements from work he had already already done. But he was there, and he thought it important to make a record of what he had witnessed. So here we are in the 1870s, and the French are beginning to vote for Republicans. In 1877, in fact, there will be a majority of Republicans in the lower house of parliament, the Chambre des Députés. The next year, the World's Fair of 1878 takes place. It is a celebration, of course, of France's recovery from the defeat of 1870, from l'année terrible, as Victor Hugo called it. France has returned, it is prosperous once again. But there is also a hint that something else is underway. You'll notice on the right side of the painting, there is a flag with gold lettering on it, which says, Vive la République. This is a scene, it made a series of paintings, not just this one, and Pat Bunker will talk about the equivalents or in the United States from a slightly later later period, of the flags decorating the city of Paris. The Republic is coming, and Monet takes note of it in this painting. In fact, in 1879, the Republic will arrive definitively, a République des Républicains. The Senate will be having a Republican majority. The sitting president, the Maréchal Mac Mahon, will resign. He's a monarchist, and be replaced by a Republican as well. Well, I've used the word Republican any number of times. I suppose it's clear to you what that means. But I'll just say a little something as a refresher. First of all, it's a set of institutions, parliamentary institutions, universal manhood suffrage, civil liberties, laïcité, which was important to the Republicans of this generation. It's a set of symbols as well. La Marseillaise, illegal to sing in the 1850s and 60s, something you can get in trouble for singing in the 1870s, is made the national anthem. So too, the device, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, which is to be put on all official official buildings. And from 1880, the 14 juillet will be celebrated as a national holiday. New policies, new symbols, and a new kind of politician. No longer notable, or aristocrats, but middle-class républicains, middle-class Democrats, like this gentleman, Dr. Georges Clemenceau, a professional man. Sometimes the republic is called la République des avocats, republic of lawyers, republic of doctors as well. And the painter here is Edouard Manet. Clemenceau, of course, knew the Impressionist painters, was very close personally to Claude Monet across almost a half century. And he knew as well Manet, for whom he posed in this painting. And it's worth underlining that there's nothing quite like this in Europe at the time. The Republican form of government, which may seem normal and typical today, was unusual in the third quarter of the 19th century. Switzerland was a republic, so was San Marino. And that's it for Europe. Nothing on this scale, on the scale of the French Republic, existed at that particular moment. I have undoubtedly forgot some republic, but I'm close enough. And indeed, to find something of such dimensions anywhere in the world, the place you would have to turn would be to the United States. And of course, the two republics, sister republics, as they called each other, acknowledged that kinship. The American government receiving a gift from the French government in 1866, 1886, forgive me, of a statue representing the common values of the two republics. I refer, of course, to the Statue of Liberty, whose interior was designed by Eiffel, its exterior by Bartholdi, which sits in New York Harbor. But of course, Paris too has two miniature versions of the Statue of Liberty, one in the Luxembourg Gardens, and one just beneath, on the island, just beneath the Pont de Grenelle. Well, as the artwork I've shown attests, at least hints, in any case, the Impressionist painters took note of what was happening around them, of how the city was changing and how the city's politics were changing at the same time. And they had views, not one like the Second Empire. The Paris Commune was a more complicated phenomenon for them. Émile Zola, as you know, in this portrait painted by Manet in 1868, wrote a novel in 1892, La Débâcle, which is, it's a polite way to put it, an unflattering portrait of the Communards. On the other hand, a number of the Impressionists knew Communards firsthand. Renoir knew Raoul Rigaud, who was the Communard chief of police. Auguste Blanqui, if I'm not mistaken, was known to some of, and that's what André Dombrowski will talk about a little later. I hope I'm getting that right in any case. Well, he's not shaking his head too negatively. And there was even some sympathy for the Communards, at least at a distance. And I read you this from a letter that Mary Cassatt wrote in 1871 to a friend. I enclose a plea for the Commune, which I wish you would read. I think it does them more justice than most of the newspaper correspondence. But while there was some disagreement about the Commune, there was none about the Republic. All were more or less enthusiastic about it. Monet was enthusiastic, and I've shown you his Vive la République, but Manet also did a Vive la République, this watercolor, in 1880. In fact, while I'm thinking of it, not long thereafter, he also did a sketch of a tricolor flag with the inscription Vive l'Amnistie. When it was decided by the New Republic to pardon former Communards, this was an amnesty. It was a controversial measure, as you could well imagine. These old revolutionaries being allowed to return to France, this was something that Manet supported. Vive l'Amnistie. And let me cite from Mary Cassatt again. She wrote to her friend, Louisine Havemeyer, "Don't talk to me about monarchies. Give me decent republics. They may be corrupt. We know they are, but the others are worse." So here we are in the 1870s and early 1880s, and there's a moment of relative consensus on political matters among the painters. A moment of friendship between France and the United States. Well, this will change, not the friendship between France and the United States, which I hope is enduring, but at least for the consensus among the painters themselves. The Parisian political scene would undergo yet one more major transformation in the final decades of the 19th century. And it would change in fundamental ways the way artists related to politics. The building boom came to an end. The last major street construction was the completion of the Avenue Napoléon, which was renamed the Avenue de l'Opéra. And of course, along with it, Charles Gagné's spectacular opera house. There would be no further grand projet, unless you count the metro construction, of whose first line opened in 1900. So the economic boom slows down, and there is in fact a general worldwide economic slump in the 1880s and 1890s, and it hits the Parisian economy hard, with three consequences that are relevant in the present context. Central Paris has been losing its working class population for a number of years as property values go up, but the slump accelerates the relocation of working populations, not just to the outer faubourg, but on beyond the city limits into the banlieue. And what you think of today as the as La Banlieue Rouge begins to form, well, it's half disappeared at this stage, but what used to be the banlieue rouge begins to take its form in the 1880s and 1890s. And these voters will begin to vote not just Republican any longer, but socialist as well. Second point, it has to do with the commercial core of central Paris, the commercial sector there, a subject which I worked on once long ago. The department store continues to do well in the 1880s and the 1890s. Business, I won't say is booming, but they're in a position to deal with the slump. In fact, a new department store is even founded in the 1890s, the Galerie Lafayette, by the partnership of Bader and Kahn. But third point, for smaller businesses with smaller profit margins, life is difficult given the economic slowdown in the 1880s and 1890s. And they begin to suffer bankruptcies and also to feel marginalized. There are political consequences. I evoked one for you already, the emergence of a kind of socialist ring, obviously not for the western suburbs of Neuilly and so on, but elsewhere. And then in the center of the city, you see emerging a new kind of politics in the core arrondissement. Unhappy shopkeepers, angry at department stores, wanting to use the tax system to penalize department stores, make them pay more. And along with this grows, how would I put it, a wave of xenophobia. And the xenophobia takes Jews in particular as its target. In 1892, Edouard Drumont launches France's first anti-Semitic newspaper, La Libre Parole. It's not many years later that a man named Jules Guérin, just to make explicit that his paper is anti-Semitic, launches a paper called L'Anti-Juif. This is the context in which the Dreyfus Affair takes place. I'll rehearse it in brief. I'm sure most of you know the general outlines. In 1894, the Army General Staff, military intelligence realizes there's someone passing military secrets to the Germans. And given the nature of the secrets, it could only be a handful of people. Major Esterhazy, Captain Dreyfus. And attention falls on Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a competent officer, but a cool one who is not well liked. Military intelligence believes it's found its spy in Alfred Dreyfus and brings him to trial before a military tribunal, a court-martial. The evidence is not the strongest. Expert test handwriting testimony. There are personal profiles which are unflattering, and also a secret dossier that's put together, shown to the military judges, but not to defense attorney. It's sufficient. They've got their man. He's found guilty, and he's sent off to Devil's Island in the French Caribbean, which is where he will remain for 5 years. Trouble begins in 1897 when a facsimile of one of the documents involved in the prosecution of Dreyfus is published in Le Matin. And one of the readers looks at it and says, I know that handwriting. That's not the handwriting of Alfred Dreyfus. It's the handwriting of Commandant Major Esterhazy. And this is made public. There's pressure to bring Esterhazy to justice. And the army accommodates in the fall of 1897. And finds him innocent. It's at this juncture that Émile Zola intervenes in the affair. He's begun to take an interest. Friends have been pushing him in this direction. And he feels something is not right in the Esterhazy decision. He produces an article on the subject with a celebrated title, published in Georges Clemenceau's newspaper, L'Aurore, in January 1898, J'accuse. The army has committed an injustice. It will, to defend its honor, not admit its mistake, but it should stand up and let Dreyfus go. He's an innocent man. Think of the lineup on behalf of Dreyfus. There's Dreyfus himself, who is Jewish. There is Émile Zola, a controversial figure still at the turn of the century. Novels tend to be a little racy, and they're certainly your bestsellers. And then finally, Georges Clemenceau, who was involved in a financial scandal early in the 1890s. And these three gentlemen are attacking the honor of the army. Well, for many French, it's a little bit too much. In fact, if France is ever to recover its lost provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, it'll be the army that will do so, and its integrity is now being attacked by the likes of these three gentlemen. There is a powerful reaction, actually, in the city of Paris itself, a series of upheavals. One of them is led by Jules Guérin, just after the publication of J'accuse. This is the man who is the editor of L'Anti-Juif. Jewish stores are attacked. Nobody's killed. There are some injuries. Then again, in February of 1899, there is a near coup d'etat. The president of the Republic, Félix Faure, dies, much in the manner of Governor Rockefeller. That's an inside joke for those who know it. In any case, in flagrante delicto, but he is buried, and there is a public funeral, and Paul Déroulède, a nationalist and anti-Dreyfusard, tries to persuade the general who is leading the cortege to march instead on the Élysée Palace and overthrow the sitting government. The general has no interest in this enterprise. And then again, in August of 1899, Jules Guérin tries his own coup d'etat, even more pathetic in many ways, and he ends up being surrounded by police in his newspaper headquarters on the Rue Chabrol, and this becomes known as the Fort Chabrol. Well, so much for the Dreyfus Affair. Oh, but one more point before I finish. The municipal elections of 1900 take place in this context. It's the spring, and the results are actually quite shocking to Parisian citizens. Paris is the city of revolution, at least it was in the 19th century. Whether you go back to 1789 or 1830 or 1848 or 1871, there is a right-wing majority in 1900 with nationalists, that is to say anti-Dreyfusards, providing the bulk of the votes for the right-wing majority. And Paris would remain throughout the 20th century, with some interruptions, a conservative city in its voting until Bertrand de La Noue is elected. Actually, it's without him. I have to say, it's without a mayor for much of this period. But all right, elected mayor. So this is pretty dramatic. And did the Impressionists just stand aside while all this was happening? And the answer is quite simply no. They did take sides. And it might be thought that they would all choose the same one. After all, old friends, Zola and Clemenceau, are leaders of the Dreyfusard cause. And indeed, Monet and Camille Pissarro were staunch Dreyfusards, wrote letters of congratulation to Zola, signed petitions in favor of Dreyfus's release. And Mary Cassatt also took a position here. She was home in the United States while much of this was happening, but she stood up for Dreyfus in salon debate in the US, and she made a brief visit to France, which led to an encounter with Madame Dreyfus in a railroad station. As Marie Cassatt described her to Louisine Havemeyer, that brave and noble wife. But there were others who went the other way. Degas in the 1890s, I presume this is well known, but just in case not, had become quite determined anti-Semite. He was a subscriber to La Libre Parole, and in fact, he'd become something of a photographer. Oh, have I jumped ahead? That was inadvertent, but I'll get to it in just a moment. And had a picture of himself taken. His eyesight was... for a photographer, still, it was dimming at this stage. And he had himself taken, being read to by a servant, and the text that's being read to him is this anti-Semitic newspaper. As for Renoir, in January 1898, just days after the publication of J'accuse, he is reported to have said, and the source for this is Julie Bonnet, who is Berthe Morisot's daughter. She's Julie Bonnet because Edouard Manet's brother, I think it's Eugène, married Berthe Morisot. and they had a daughter, Julie. And they died young, and Julie was looked after by Renoir and Degas, and she would write as a young person about her encounters with these great and famous men. And she noted Renoir having said, "The Jews come to France to make money, but the moment a fight is on, they hide behind the first tree. There are so many in the army because the Jews like to parade around in fancy uniforms. Every country chases them out. There's a reason for that, and we must not allow them to occupy such a position in France." The affair, in fact, causes ruptures among the painters. Renoir will no longer greet Pissarro in the street. These are men who'd worked together, side by side, exhibited together, and now when they pass in the street, there is no greeting between them. Cézanne and Zola, who had been childhood friends, I think from college, in Aix-en-Provence, had a rupture. There are many reasons for it, but one of them is they took different sides. Cézanne believed Dreyfus was guilty, and Zola, of course, was the leader, one of the leaders of the Dreyfusard cause. And then there's Degas and Marie Cassatt. And once very, very close to each other, he had supported her career and helped her along as an artist, but they have a rupture, and it's exactly over the Dreyfus affair. Degas is moving more to the right, towards anti-Semitism, and this is something that Judith Barter will talk about in the afternoon. Marie Cassatt was moving in another direction towards suffragism, rights for women, votes for women. But they have a later meeting where they patch things up a little bit, but the way Marie Cassatt describes it is he's gotten a lot older. And it's a rather sad reunion of some sort. So the affair broke open the Impressionist movement. There had been a moment of unity and a relative consensus in the 1870s and 1880s, but by the turn of the century, this was no longer the case. So that moment of unity was a passing moment. A quite beautiful one in its way. And the poignancy of its passing is brought to mind by this Renoir oil. Alice and Elisabeth Comte d'Anvers, painted in 1881. These are the younger daughters of a distinguished Jewish banking family. Their older sister, whom Renoir would also paint, married Moise de Commando, who was the owner of the quite exquisite mansion on the Parc Monceau, which some of you will have visited. This picture is charming, perhaps too much so. The following year, Renoir would break with the Comte d'Anvers, whom he found too stingy. "I'm washing my hands of the Jews," as he explained to a friend. As for the girls depicted here, Alice lived until 1865, that's the little girl in pink, but not so Elizabeth, who was deported to Auschwitz in 1944 via the French transit camp at Drancy, and she died en route. It's a reminder, this painting, at least to me, that that beautiful intersection of democratic politics and avant-garde artists was a passing one, and it's a reminder as well that the beauties of the Impressionist moment are not that far removed from the catastrophes of the 20th century. Thank you.